Chapter 11. The Tungi. Spring had come early to the Tungi. The landscape was lush with wild almond and blooming acacias and flowering privet, and the fields were a brilliant green. Wheat fields and fruit orchards crisscrossed the narrow watershed basin between the two mountain chains that formed the valley's walls, no more than half a mile apart at their widest. Those mountains rose thousands of feet, dense and interlocking, a rock fortress. During the 1980s, the Soviets could never bring the Tungi to heel. Now, in 2005, it would prove the perfect place for a nascent Taliban insurgency to germinate. It had been nearly a month since Akbar Gul had spoken to Abbas, and on a warm March day, he had received a second call, with instructions to head to the Tungi. Early the next morning, he drove his station wagon through the valley basin into a green thicket, pulling up to a house standing alone among the trees. The wall enclosure had partially crumbled away, exposing the yard. Weeds had edged over the walkway leading to the guest house, and trash was strewn everywhere. The windows were fractured, the walls pitted with the marks of some forgotten battle. No one was at home, so he let himself in. The guest room carpet smelled of onions, and was imprinted here and there with boot tracks. Soiled linens were heaped in a pile. In one corner, he noticed a brand new Panasonic TV and DVD player. He settled down and waited. More than an hour passed, and then Abbas walked in, followed soon after by a pair of armed men and a large gentleman with a well-manicured beard, wearing a stately black turban. Akbar Gul recognized him at once as Mufti Abdul Latif, an old friend from the Taliban days. They exchanged greetings and sat down for tea.
"We aren't rich people," Abdul Latif explained. "We have nothing. We live by the grace of God. We'd like you to work with us."
"I'm ready," Akbar Gul replied. But he had many questions. "Where is Mullah Omar? Is he alive?"
"Praise God, Mullah Omar is alive and safe. He's in Pakistan."
"And everyone else?"
"They are all in Pakistan. They're busy working."
"Who is funding us?"
"We're getting money from Saudi Arabia, from Pakistan, and from Al-Qaeda."
"Where is Al-Qaeda, Bin Laden?"
"No one knows, but their friends give us money sometimes."
"What do you want me to do?" Abdul Latif knew Akbar Gul well. He also had an eye for human weakness, for pride in particular. He said,
"I want you to be governor of Chok District. You'll be responsible for all of it."
"Governor." Akbar Gul liked the sound of that. It was something he could get behind, put his efforts into. He wasn't the lowlife that the police had treated him as. He was smarter, more talented than almost anyone he knew in the village. A man of his caliber was destined to lead. He would be governor of Chok. Of course, he knew that Chok District had a Karzai-appointed U.S.-backed governor, but it was clear to him that the new Taliban were already thinking of themselves as a government in waiting, and he wasn't about to be left behind. Mufti Latif handed him a Kalashnikov and about $330 in Afghan currency.
"Everything else," he said, "is up to you and God."
Akbar Gul would be responsible for fundraising, recruiting men to fight under him, arming them, all on his own. Luckily for him, resourcefulness was his strong suit. He carefully wrapped the Kalashnikov in a flour bag and tied it to the underside of his car. As the sun grew faint, he drove out of the valley onto the highway, passing police checkpoints, and arrived home in the darkness. He hid the weapon in an old outdoor tandoor and went in for dinner. Later that night, he phoned his village friends. By midnight, 11 of them had assembled at his house. Young and unemployed, they had found little to savor in the post-2001 world.
"It was good to put these sort of people to work," Akbar Gul said.
There was Eunice, his closest friend, who had lent him money to set up his cell phone shop and had grown so fed up with the police that he was ready for anything. Habib Rahman was a driver who, when he did find work, was regularly shaken down by the police for bribes. Walid was unemployed and looking for money and excitement. Saeed Mohammed, the most religious among them, was also out of work and looking to make ends meet.
Hamidullah toiled over a small plot of poor soil, frustrated by just about everything from the police to his lazy cousins. A couple of friends had shown up because Taliban from other villages were harassing them, and they were looking for a group of their own for protection. Everyone shared an intense disgust with what the Americans had done to their country, their tribal elders, and their customs. Akbar Gul addressed the room.
"I don't want to be like other Taliban groups. We aren't going to do hit-and-run attacks and spend our days in the mountains. I want us to be strong and open, out there. I want to control the roads and attack them in broad daylight."
People sat listening in admiration.
"We're all afraid of the enemy nowadays. My goal is to change that. I want to make the enemy afraid of us."
He divided up the $300 among the men.
"God is merciful," he said.
For the moment, at least, he knew he had their loyalty. And for the first time in years, he felt like himself again. To hold court, to fill men's minds with visions of your own, to matter. That was what he'd been missing. Just one issue remained. Weapons. A year earlier, halfway across the country in Uruzgan province, a similar story had unfolded for Mullah Manan. It began one morning during the harvest season, when, as always, he was in the fields before dawn. Under the sun, poppy sap was too dry, too crusted, doubling or tripling his work. And the labor was hard enough as it was. That day, he was on his knees, lancing the bulbs and watching the sap dribble out, then lancing them again, and a third time, the sap richer with every cut. It was good work. Ever since Manan's defeat in 2001 at the Battle of Tirinkot, opium had been his provider. It paid for his sister's salwars, for his nephew's school supplies, for their daily naan. The Taliban's collapse, it turned out, had been a great boon for the village. Everyone was able to get back to growing the stuff, which was hardier than wheat or corn, and had two harvest seasons to boot. In fact, poppy cultivation was flourishing province-wide, and everyone, from tribal elders to government functionaries to John Muhammad himself, had a hand in it. With the sun high, he went inside, his muscles burning, his knees tender. In the early days after the invasion, Manan had listened to the hand-cranked radio on his breaks. The BBC would discuss President Karzai and the international donors helping to develop the country, and Manan felt that, despite the ignominy of his defeat, it was a great thing the Americans were doing. Nowadays, however, he wasn't so sure. In the afternoon, when the air cooled, he returned to the field and crawled from bulb to bulb, collecting sap. In a few weeks, brokers would arrive and pay good money for it, then carry it off to other countries for processing. For a kilo of sap, he could get almost double compared to potatoes or wheat. He was scraping the bulbs when he looked up to see plumes of smoke rising from a neighbor's plot. He went over to take a look. The farmer was frantically hacking down his own poppy field, like a man possessed. Flames danced and leapt from one patch to the next. The farmer saw Manan and shouted, "John Muhammad is coming!" Manan raced back to his field. He knew that the government did not look kindly on people like him growing poppies, but they had never bothered him before. He saw a group of vehicles nearby, with American Humvees idling behind them. Four Afghans, wearing bandoliers and salwars, ran toward him with weapons raised. He threw his hands up and soon they were on him, shouting, "Get down, you dirty Talib! Get down, you dog!" In a moment, he was lying face down in the dirt, being kicked and jabbed in the ribs with the barrel of a gun. He was dragged to a jeep and tossed into the back seat. The militiamen returned to the fields and retrieved other farmers, and soon the jeep was bursting with bruised and bewildered men. The Americans stood in the distance, watching. As the jeep pulled away, he looked back and saw the militiamen setting his fields aflame. In prison, Manan discovered that he'd been rounded up as part of an American program to eradicate poppy cultivation, conducted with the help of JMK, who was seemingly using the program to wipe out Gilzai competition and keep prices high. For 12 days, he and the other farmers were kept in a claustrophobic cell. Freedom was reserved for those who could pay, so he passed word to his family to auction off their livestock. When he returned home, he walked out onto the field and looked over what had become of his livelihood. The soil was ashen, covered with rotting opium paste. The bulbs had charred to nubs. Even part of the mud-walled enclosure was torn down. He wanted only one thing, to walk into the governor's mansion and shoot the man himself, or onto an American base and gun down the whole lot of them. But what could he do? There was no one to complain to, no advocate for his village. His best hope, the Gilzai elder Muhammad Nabi, had disappeared after repeated American arrests. Every Friday, the ruined farmers gathered at the local mosque after prayers to discuss the situation. Among them was the charismatic Mullah Dilara, an ex-Taliban commander who had sworn off politics and taken to a life of quiet preaching. Now, seething with anger at what was happening to his village and to Gilzai elders across Uruzgan, he did most of the talking. Manan was happy to listen because Dilara had the gift of a silver tongue. Manan had assumed that the campaign of persecution was just one in a long line of injustices, stretched back to the Civil War, that people of his lot were destined to suffer forever. This was how things were, and how they would always be. Dilara begged to differ. This abuse, he said, felt more immediate, more personal. Their community was being targeted simply because they were from the Gilzai tribe, and it did not stop there. Their Pashtun ethnicity was similarly in the crosshairs, for it was clear that Hazaras were escaping the worst of this. And with the American raids, with the assassinations and disappearances of their elders, their very way of life as Afghans and Muslims was under threat. Mullah Dilara would repeat that phrase often, our way of life. The Americans, he explained, invaded because they hated the Afghan way of life. It was not long before Manan finally asked Dilara how they could sit idly by while this was going on. In Kandahar, people have already started to work, he replied. They are brave, and they are doing something about it. It seemed to Manan that it would be an impossible task to stand up to the likes of JMK and the Americans. Dilara reminded him that their fathers had thought the same of the Russians. If it's in your heart, he said, if you love your country and your religion, that's what matters. Then he cited a Pashtun proverb, a dog curls his tail, but a man fights. Later that summer, his fields unsown, his relatives idle indoors, his household finances stretched to the breaking point, Mullah Manan too went back to work. For a week, Akbar Gul had been mulling over the question of weapons. From his initial meeting of 11, 8 had pledged to fight under him. 8 men to be fed and armed and led as well as he could. One day, a potential solution suddenly came to him. It depended on a friendship he had made with a man named Pir Momand a decade earlier on the front lines of the Civil War. Momand hailed from Akbar Gul's neighborhood in Kabul and had fought with him in Hizbi Islami and then the Taliban. Now he worked for the U.S. Special Forces as a member of a private militia operating outside government jurisdiction. His job was to transport fuel from Kabul along hundreds of highway miles to American bases near the Pakistani border. The pay for the lonely 6-hour haul was modest, and Akbar Gul wondered whether he could entice Momand with the promise of something better. The plan went like this. During an early morning delivery, Momand would hand over a full tanker of fuel to Akbar Gul and go into hiding for a few days. He would then claim that he had been kidnapped and the fuel stolen at gunpoint. Akbar Gul would sell the fuel on the black market and the pair would split the profits. Momand spent some days mulling it over, then called to say he was in. It was long before dawn when Akbar Gul set out again for the Tangi Valley. He drove through the night, the spur of the mountains ahead lying dark against the sky. Crossing the valley floor, the gravel road banked up and hugged the northern slope. He passed some mud villages and some made of stone, and he saw in the valley below him the darkened minaret of the Tangi Mosque. Farther on, the valley widened and the road sloped down into it, and the valley basin gave way to a broad Piedmont plain, marking the beginning of Logar province. He drove on, and there was not a house in sight. The gravel road crossed the plain to meet with another, which had once been asphalted and now lay fractured. He looked to the direction of Kabul, an hour off, and saw only darkness. In the other direction, the road ran to the far horizon, where it was swallowed by a mountain range, beyond which lay the provinces bordering Pakistan. At the intersection of the two roads stood the broken remains of a mud village wiped away by some battle or some neglect of which he did not know. He turned off the engine and waited. Somewhere in the distance, he could hear the first strains of the morning's call to prayer. The roads were empty and still. The sky began to pale. It was possible that Momand had lost his nerve, or worse, had tipped someone off. He sat in the dawn light, thinking about all the things that could go wrong, or probably had gone wrong, and the trouble he'd find himself in, when a police truck rolled up to ask what business he had out there. It was arrogance to have assumed that he could pull this off. He would get what he deserved. Then he spotted a pair of headlights off in the distance, bouncing toward him. It was soon followed by a second pair of headlights. Two tankers. Something must have gone awry. Then the lead tanker flashed its lights three times, the prearranged signal, and Akbar Gul knew that he was in business. Momand had recruited an accomplice. He casually slipped his station wagon ahead of the vehicles. Turning back onto the gravel road, he led them straight into the Tangi. By that spring, there were 12 small, nearly autonomous Taliban groups operating in Wardak province, all under the authority of former field commanders like Akbar Gul. Each group was left to its own devices to raise funds and weapons, resulting in a weak and divided movement. Commanders were scrounging for money, some even traveling to Pakistan in search of donations, and often returning empty-handed. In this atmosphere, news of a Taliban commander wheeling two fuel trucks from the hated Americans through the Tangi must have seemed like the heist of the century. Sure enough, word of the conquest spread through the valley as farmers gossiped, and the tankers multiplied in the telling. Within days, Akbar Gul sold off all the fuel, split his share with Momand and the other driver, and set the trucks ablaze. News outlets reported that the two trucks had been attacked. With this windfall of cash, Akbar Gul contacted Jabbar, an old acquaintance adept at finding whatever was needed, and ready to deal with anyone for the right price. What Akbar Gul needed was weapons. Kalashnikovs, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, mines, mortars, and his weapon of choice, the Dushka, a Soviet-made heavy machine gun. Jabbar took Akbar Gul on a three-hour drive to Beysud, a Hazara district at the far western edge of Wardak. Many Hazara warlords, enthusiastic backers of the Americans and the Karzai government, were being forced to surrender their weapons for nominal compensation as part of the UN disarmament program, weapons that would fetch a far higher price on the black market. So they were selling their stocks to Hazara arms smugglers instead, and Jabbar was in contact with one of them. Akbar Gul returned home with mortars, RPG rounds, Chinese-made AK-47s, and a gritty old PK machine gun. The irony ran deep. The main former Taliban commanders in Wardak had sided with the Americans after 2001 and publicly surrendered their weapons, only to end up in prisons, while not long after, U.S.-backed commanders like these Hazara strongmen began secretly selling their weapons to the newly reconstructed Taliban. Back home, Akbar Gul called his group in and showed off his haul. No one could believe that he had gotten guns so quickly. He handed one to each man. That evening, long after the village had retired, he and his fighters stepped out onto the darkened macadam road near the bazaar. The shops were shuttered, and the night was as perfectly still and black as a country night could be, save for the occasional headlights of an oncoming vehicle. Akbar Gul studied the traffic. Then he walked into the middle of the road and pointed his gun at an approaching car. It was the very first Taliban checkpoint in Chak District. The summer of 2005 was long and hot and angry. American fatalities countrywide began to rise, nearly doubling from the previous year, and kidnappings and assassinations of government officials came in record numbers. Newspapers started writing about the resurgence of the Taliban, and for the first time, Washington contemplated sending in more troops. For Akbar Gul, the summer officially commenced late one June night, when he directed his men to dig a hole under the highway leading to the turnoff to his village. Jabbar had provided the bomb, smuggled in from Pakistan and triggered by a pressure plate mechanism. To ensure that they took out a suitable target, Akbar Gul posted observers about a mile ahead to radio back when the right vehicle approached. Sometime after dinner, a police ranger drove slowly up the highway. As it neared the turnoff, it exploded into flames. Everyone inside was killed. Later, Akbar Gul complained to Mufti Latif that pressure plate bombs were too dangerous and indiscriminate, requiring constant supervision if civilian deaths were to be avoided. Latif arranged for a visitor from Pakistan, a bespectacled, clean-shaven Arab in his 20s, to instruct the group on more advanced bomb-making techniques. This would be the first and last time Akbar Gul met anyone from Al-Qaeda. The relevance of bin Laden's organization to Afghanistan had diminished since 2001. Still, the group wielded a certain tactical influence on the resurgent Taliban movement. In that 2005 summer, for example, suicide bombings first began occurring in Afghanistan in significant numbers. The Taliban's senior brass had been divided on their use, with many in the old guard, including Mullah Omar, pointing to Quranic prohibitions against suicide and harboring a general distaste for the sort of indiscriminate violence then tearing Iraq apart. But politics has a way of making a virtue of necessity, and soon suicide bombers became the outgunned Taliban's answer to B-52s and up-armored Humvees. It would be some years before Akbar Gul saw his first suicide bomber. For now, he was content to deploy the newfangled Arab bombs, command-detonated and devastatingly effective. Soon his unit was burying roadside bombs up and down the highway near Chalk, then waiting, hours sometimes, for a target. Within a week, they had taken out 4 police vehicles. Twice, the American convoys drove right into their trap. The first time, Akbar Gul hit the lead vehicle and watched from a nearby field as it popped straight up in the air, landing armor cracked and smoking. The second time, he struck a middle vehicle with a large antenna, which he hoped signaled the presence of a commander inside. The blast tore a hole clean through it and left the trailing vehicle jackknifed. By summer's end, that stretch of road had come to be known among Americans as IED Alley, a billing that, when Akbar Gul learned of it, filled him with pride. The police, in fact, quit patrolling the road after dark altogether. Americans passed through rarely and only with their lights off. He had been in business for less than a year, and already he owned the night. In winter, snows set upon Wardak and many roads become impassable. Orchards frost over, and only a few scattered pine forests survive, and people stay indoors, feeding wood or sawdust to their Bukhari heating stoves. Akbar Gul stored his gun and retired to his village for the season. Only when the valleys thawed in late spring did he return to work. It was now 2006, and with a successful year under his belt, he set his sights on a new goal, daytime missions. He was intent on keeping his promise, to operate unafraid of the enemy, hitting them out there. The first such assault took place in late May, when he and Ghulam Ali, another local commander, brought their men, about 30 in all, to a Tangi hilltop overlooking a police outpost. Akbar Gul could see 7 poorly equipped policemen eating lunch, their guard down in the daylight. On his command, the 2 teams swarmed down the hillside firing RPGs. The police barely had a chance. 4 were killed instantly. The 3 others fled into the open scrubland near the highway, where Akbar Gul's fighters picked them off like hunted game. Inside the outpost, the fighters discovered cases of precious ammunition and 4 Kalashnikovs. Using his cell phone, Akbar Gul snapped a photo of himself standing triumphantly amid the weapons and sent it to Mufti Latif. This was how Taliban commanders now proved their worth. The movement that had once shunned moving images and photography could no longer operate without them. The photographs wound up in the possession of Taliban leaders in Pakistan, and Akbar Gul was soon rewarded with a few $1,000s. With the fresh infusion of money and weapons, he was able to attract more farmers to the group. His force expanded to 15. That summer, his attacks grew even bolder. Each one left him wanting more, each a high for which the only fix was greater, grander, showier. In August, he he again teamed up with Ghulam Ali, attacking and briefly overrunning the Chak District Governor's compound, the first such conquest in Wardak. To carry out the raid, he had resorted to tricking some of his own men. "Whenever we went on big missions, the important ones," he recalled, "there were a few of my guys who would volunteer to stay back and guard the village. They were terrified of bullets." He grinned at me. "Two of them were nearly married. They liked to spend time with their wives. You know, they were addicted to it." He had convinced them that they were only going to attack a small outpost near the governor's mansion, until the very moment when he opened fire at the mansion itself, leaving his shocked fighters no choice but to join in. The momentary capture of a government headquarters made national news and brought Akbar Ghul further acclaim from the leadership. His group now numbered 30 strong. Another winter came and went, and 2007 brought more violence than anyone had seen since the Civil War years. The UN estimated that the Taliban had reclaimed control of more than half of rural Pashtun territory countrywide. By year's end, officials had logged more than 5,000 security incidents. Roadside bombings, kidnappings, assassinations, ambushes. Akbar Ghul and Ghulam Ali were no longer alone in Chak, as farmers and religious students of all stripes began to join the fray. By now, there were a half dozen Taliban groups active in that district alone. In the winter of 2007, for the first time, some Taliban groups remained active despite heavy snows, as ever more villagers flocked to the Taliban side. And after only a few months, 2008 had already broken the previous year's record for violence. Most of this was unfolding far from the eyes of Kabul-based reporters. Through contacts with the Taliban leadership, I was able to secure permission to venture into Taliban country, and that summer, I hopped on a motorcycle with an Afghan friend and headed for Chak. We zipped along the country's main arterial highway connecting Kabul to Kandahar, which slices right through Wardak province. Paved 5 years prior, to the tune of millions of dollars, it now stretched out before me as a roadway devoured, pocked and cratered with culverts here and there burst open. We passed the disemboweled remains of fuel tankers, charred vendor stalls, and small police outposts where the officers hold up, refusing to step out day or night. In Chak, we pulled into a small village. We spent the afternoon with the Malik eating watermelons in the shade of almond trees, near a small stream of tea-colored water with a few sun-blanched mud homes on the opposite bank. Village children sat nearby, watching us talk. Occasionally a Taliban fighter walked past, looked at us, and continued on. The Malik told me that the village had been under Taliban control for nearly 2 years, and in that time, crime had vanished. The Taliban court adjudicated disputes and sentenced criminals, something only a bribe would have achieved in government courts. He explained how Taliban police had captured a known child molester and turned him over to Islamic justice, with judges tarring his face, parading him around Chak, and forcing him to apologize publicly. If caught again, he was told, he would be executed. The Malik would not say it, but this service, as important as it may have been, was the extent of the Taliban's governing activities. For the rest, life remained frozen. No jobs, no development, no aid. Still, for the time being at least, people preferred Taliban austerity to government and foreign impunity. These transformations were unfolding only 50 miles from Kabul, with its embassies and aid offices and government ministries. Wresting control of Wardak, which the Americans referred to as Kabul's doorstep, from the Taliban, would become a major goal of the Obama administration's attempts to turn the war around. Shortly after assuming office, President Obama ordered a mini-surge of troops into the country, including a battalion from the 10th Mountain Division, dispatched to the strategically crucial Logar and Wardak provinces. The Americans were coming to Chak. The first time Akbar Ghul saw a U.S. soldier, he was amazed. "You know, I'll never forget it," he recalled. "We were sitting in a guest house, nursing steaming cups of cardamom tea. It had taken him a while to get to the Americans in his story, perhaps because in the early days of our meetings, he could never quite shake the suspicion that I was a spy. I was in the bazaar,
chatting with some shopkeepers who were my friends. I didn't have a weapon or anything with me. I was just relaxing, and all of a sudden, they came by.
He counted more than a dozen soldiers. You know, they were all different colors. I was so surprised. I saw white ones and black ones.
He pointed a bony finger in my direction. Even some that looked like you. I realized on that day that I didn't know the first thing about these people.
The soldiers were swaddled in gear, helmets, vests, wires poking out of various pockets. They walked uncomfortably, as if in great pain. Akbar Gul glanced down at his own unadorned salwar and sandaled feet, and couldn't decide which of the two sides was more foolish. The soldiers worked their way through the bazaar single file. When they reached his stall, the man in front turned to Akbar Gul and smiled, but the others eyed him coldly. An Afghan translator, looking awkward in his uniform, followed close behind. Within seconds, the group had passed, and soon they returned to their vehicles and drove off. Akbar Gul knew that he must be on some list of theirs, but fortunately, no public photographs of him existed. Still, he decided to play things safe and spend a few nights away from home with his friend Ismail. He woke late that night to the sound of distant thunder. Straining to listen, he could hear a helicopter hovering somewhere nearby. Americans, he thought. He reached for his Kalashnikov. Lights flashed outside. Every few minutes, he heard a dull thud and realized these must be explosions. They were doing house searches, blowing off gates. Ismail appeared in the doorway.
What do you want to do?
Akbar Gul studied the window. If he ran for it, he might make it to the fields abutting the village. But if the Americans were there already?
We'll stay here, he decided. They won't search every house.
He knew that they were probably looking for him. He was, after all, one of the most prominent commanders in the province, and the only one in this village. He looked over at Ismail, who was a worried mess. He was a civilian, a poor farmer, who opened his guest house to the Taliban, tribal elders, or whoever else passed through. He had certainly not signed up for this.
You should get out of here, Akbar Gul said. I'll take care of it.
Ismail shot him a grateful look and left. Akbar Gul hid his weapon and for the next hours sat in the guest house waiting. The Americans, he knew, would be angry. In the previous week, he'd planted a bomb that destroyed one of their vehicles and probably killed one of their soldiers. By the morning's first light, the explosions had ceased and the sky had fallen silent. He decided to test the outdoors. Slipping through a warren of donkey trails between the houses, he emerged onto the escarpment leading away from the village. At the next village, he took shelter in the house of a friend and waited. The sun was high by the time he sent the friend out and learned that the Americans were again approaching. He was spirited away to a smaller hut, perched atop a hill from which he could observe the houses below. He scanned the roofs and the narrow lanes. And then he saw them, gathered around the compound of an elder, meaty men in sunglasses and hats. One of them sat down with the elder. On a nearby hill, four soldiers stood guard. Four exposed soldiers, he realized, for all the world to see. That was when he got the idea. He stole back to his village to retrieve his walkie-talkie and radioed Ghulam Ali and three other commanders, asking them to rendezvous in a nearby fruit orchard with men ready to fight. It was late afternoon when the four commanders gathered in a thicket of apple trees near the occupied village. They had nearly 100 fighters under them, but only 20 had shown up. Ambushing the Americans, after all, was a far cry from hitting the hapless Afghan police. Akbar Gul divided the group into four, two teams moving under tree cover toward the hill, one in a nearby graveyard with a good line of sight to the target, and the fourth in the orchard as a rear guard. He led one of the mobile teams through the fruit farm. About half a mile ahead, he could see the small knoll and the Americans still pacing atop it. He came to a 10-foot-high mud enclosure, the back wall of a farmer's compound, at the foot of the hill. Climbing onto the shoulders of one of his men, he peeked over, balancing an RPG launcher with one arm. The Americans stood talking among themselves.
This is it, he thought. This is how great men are made. Ready for lunch.
he spoke into his walkie-talkie. Let's eat. Within seconds, gunshots erupted from the far side of the hill. As the American soldiers scrambled for cover, Akbar Gul aimed his launcher and fired. The Americans were shooting back wildly. He reloaded and fired again. There was gunfire coming in now from multiple directions. His man was beginning to wobble under him, so he climbed off and onto another fighter. Three of the Americans had taken cover behind some boulders. The fourth was nowhere to be seen. Many minutes passed as the firing continued, and in a haze of smoke and dust, Akbar Gul could no longer see what he was shooting at. He began to worry about American reinforcements. He had just radioed his concern to Ghulam Ali when the air pulsed with a sound that did not belong. Suddenly, the world exploded. Unbearable heat. Smoke mud thick. A ringing in his ears. He'd fallen off his compatriot's shoulders, and he could hear the plane returning. Reaching for his walkie-talkie, he spoke in the calmest tone he could muster. It's okay. Just run. Don't worry. Just run. 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 That evening, the commanders regrouped in the mountains. Remarkably, there were no injuries. They spoke among themselves of how cowardly the Americans were, how without their airplanes this war would be over in months. The mood was triumphant, their narrow escape evidence that God was on their side. Then they received news from the village. The airstrike had flattened the house whose wall Akbar Gul had used for cover, and ravaged the apple orchards through which they had escaped. Akbar Gul felt deeply ashamed. He wondered how he could possibly face the villagers. But was it his fault? The Americans had chosen to come to Wardak, he reasoned. He'd never asked for it. They had placed themselves in the middle of the village, and he was doing the best he could, the best anyone could, under such conditions. Much later, I asked him if he felt remorse. He gave me a surprised look and said with a touch of rancor, "You can't ask me that. Americans won't ever feel what we feel. Your problems have solutions." We both fell silent, and he looked hard at the floor. Finally, he said, "Yes, it was a terrible thing. But we were scared. When death appears in front of you, no one hugs it. This is war." Still, he felt that the mission had been a success. Days after the attack, he had trekked up the hill and found blood splattered on the rocks. That evening, he called Mufti Latif and reported that four Americans had been killed. Later, trying to verify his account, I came across the U.S. military log for the skirmish, released by WikiLeaks in 2010. No one, it turned out, had been killed in the incident. Back in Chak, though, that mattered not. The death of four American soldiers at the hands of Akbar Gul's fighters became truth itself, and soon he was awarded more money by the leadership. His group now numbered nearly 40 strong, and Akbar Gul's name was catching attention in Taliban ranks across Wardak province. Fresh off his success, he set to devising even more daring assaults. As with any great ambition, however, war has a stubborn way of becoming an end in itself. Like the Americans, Akbar Gul would learn this the hard way.